Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one to ask a question. I would like to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Lola Russell. You may begin.
Thank you so much for joining us today on this CDC and Texas Department of State Health Services update on the West Nile virus numbers, and we will provide you also with an update on the situation in Texas. So a national perspective as well as what's going on in particular in Texas, where, as you know, the half of the volume of cases of neuroinvasive disease of West Nile virus are taking place there. Our lineup today includes Dr. Lyle Peterson, who is director of our Division of Vector-Borne Infectious Diseases here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as Dr. David Lakey, who is the commissioner for the Texas Department of State Health Services. Dr. Peterson will begin with a statement, followed by one by Dr. Lakey, and we will take one question and follow-up from reporters after both doctors have given their statements. Dr. Peterson.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and thank you for all of you for joining us. This is the second national telebriefing we've held this month to release information about the current West Nile virus disease outbreak in the United States. This information was posted this morning on CDC's West Nile virus website. That's www.cdc.gov/West Nile. I want to thank our partners at state public health departments nationwide who regularly provide CDC with their updated numbers and thus make it possible for us to track what's happening with the epidemic. As we have reported in recent weeks, the number of people reported with West Nile virus continues to rise. We've seen this trend in previous West Nile epidemics, and so the increase we report today is not unexpected. In fact, we think the reported numbers we will get will get higher through October. We recognize that people are worried about the threat of West Nile virus this season, and we want to assure you that we're working closely with state and local governments to contain the outbreak. As of August 28, 2012, a total of 48 states have reported West Nile virus infections in people, birds, or mosquitoes. Only Alaska and Hawaii have reported no West Nile virus activity. 43 states have reported at least one human case of West Nile virus disease. CDC received reports of 1,590 cases of West Nile virus disease in people, including 66 deaths. Of these, 889, or 56%, were classified as neuroinvasive disease, such as meningitis or encephalitis, and 701, or 44%, were classified as non-neuroinvasive disease. These numbers represent a 40% increase over last week's report of 1,118 total cases, 629 neuroinvasive disease cases, and 41 deaths. The 1,590 cases reported thus far in 2012 is the highest number of West Nile virus disease cases reported to CDC through the last week in August since West Nile virus was first detected in the United States in 1999. More than 70% of the cases have been reported from six states, which in descending order are Texas, South Dakota, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Michigan. Nearly half of the cases are reported from Texas. We cannot accurately predict how many human cases will be reported this year. However, based on current reports, we think the numbers may come close to or even exceed the total number reported in the epidemic years of 2002 and 2003, when about 3,000 cases of neuroinvasive disease and more than 260 deaths were reported each year. Because cases of West Nile fever, or non-neuroinvasive disease, are very underreported, we think the cases of neuroinvasive disease are the best measures of the severity of the epidemic. From what we've seen in West Nile virus epidemics in previous years, we expect that this year's epidemic will peak in mid to late August. The incidence of infection may peak earlier in southern states than in northern ones. And now I'd like to say a few words about Hurricane Isaac and the question of how it might affect the spread of West Nile virus. Previous experience has shown that floods and hurricanes do not typically result in increased transmission of West Nile virus. Thus, we expect Hurricane Isaac will likely have no noticeable effect on the current West Nile virus epidemic. Nevertheless, small increases in the numbers of West Nile cases were noted in some areas of Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina. These were thought to be due to increased outdoor exposure that occurred when houses were severely damaged and during recovery efforts. CDC has reached out to health departments in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee to alert them of the situation and offer assistance. In light of the ongoing risk for West Nile virus infection, it is important for people to protect themselves from mosquito bites. We encourage everyone to use insect repellents when you go outdoors, wear long sleeves and pants during dawn and dusk, install or repair screens on windows and doors, use air conditioning if possible, empty standing water from items outside your home such as gutters, flower pots, buckets, kiddie pools, and bird baths, and support your local community mosquito control programs. In response to this year's outbreak, CDC continues its public outreach and ongoing efforts to work closely with state and local health departments, particularly in areas that have been hardest hit by the epidemic. As I noted earlier, nearly half this year's West Nile virus cases have occurred in Texas, and a majority of the cases there have been in the Dallas area. CDC has had the privilege of working with the Texas Department of State Health Services and Dallas County and other county health departments to help protect people from West Nile virus. They've done a terrific job. Dr. Lakey is going to give an update about the situation in Texas. Dr. Lakey?
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. And again, I want to thank the CDC for their support for the state of Texas as we were working through this major outbreak. And also want to thank the media for their involvement. They've been critical in getting the key public health preventative messages out throughout the state of Texas. We all here in the state of Texas continue to be very concerned about the disease and the disease that we're seeing here in Texas, but also in other parts of the United States. Obviously, we'll focus on the data, but again, we understand that it's more than just the data, that there's been a large number of people whose lives have been changed related to the outbreak of this event. I think one of the issues that a lot of people have is, you know, have we peaked in Texas or not? At this time, as I look at the data, I'm not convinced that we have peaked. We may have plateaued, but I'm not convinced yet that we have peaked. But that's something that we're watching very closely and intensifying our efforts to make sure that we control the disease, especially if we see increased disease in a different part of the state than we've had before. I'm going to go through some of the data, and again, kind of comparing it from where we are now versus last week. I think one of those messages as we all look through this data is that some of these data, pieces of data, are lagging indicators. As we talk about the cases of neuroinvasive disease and deaths, that doesn't necessarily indicate increased disease transmission right now. Those are lagging indicators related to the activity that's occurred over the last month here in the state of Texas. But as we look at the data statewide in the state of Texas, as of this morning, we had 783 state-confirmed cases of West Nile disease. That's up 197 from last time we talked last week. And we've had 31 deaths. That's up 10 from our discussion last week. We've had 416 cases of West Nile neuroinvasive disease. And again, that's up 93 from this time last week. Now, those numbers are going to continue to go up. I think we have a lot of reports that are being entered right now, and those numbers will be updated this afternoon, so we know that there will be additional cases and additional deaths that will be entered into the system later today. Assuming normal disease progression, this looks to us like it's going to be our worst year with West Nile. again, I said that we had 416 cases of West Nile neuroinvasive disease as of this morning. In 2003, we had 439. So just looking at disease progression, knowing the cases that are going to be entered, that this will be our worst year. In 2003, we had 40 deaths, and again, we're at 31 so far this year. So we're closely evaluating the disease incidence from all counties in the state of Texas, but focusing on certain counties that have been hardest hit. If you want specific data for any county in the state of Texas, I would direct you to www.txwestnile.org. That was www.txwestnile.org. And again, on that website, we have the county-specific data. But let me focus in on two areas. One is the Dallas situation. As of this morning, Dallas City Health Department, City County Health Department, had reported 309 cases. 152 of those were the West Nile neuroinvasive disease. And Dallas County alone has 12 deaths. Now, we've completed our aerial spraying in Dallas County. We completed it last Thursday night. We sprayed 437,500 acres twice, so a total of 875,000 acres were sprayed in the course of six nights. That aerial spraying was just part of the overall response. Several areas we focused our ground spraying in, and so it's been a combination of aerial spraying and ground spraying. In Denton County, Denton County has a smaller population, but their incidence has been at the top for the state. The local health department there has reported 128 cases, 38 cases of West Nile neuroinvasive disease, and they've had two deaths. We are working with Denton County right now and the cities in Denton County to determine what, again, Texas is a home rule state. Some we've offered aerial spraying. Some cities want aerial spraying. Some have decided not to have aerial spraying. But as of just a little while ago, 30 cities in Denton County have opted in to aerial spraying. And so we're pulling those resources together, working with the local officials, and that spraying activity will begin tomorrow night. A lot of our focus has been in Dallas and North Texas, but we're also mindful that the disease is impacting other parts of the state, and so we're working very closely with several parts of the state of Texas, making sure that they're getting the support they need to be able to confront this outbreak. So we're in close communication with health departments from across our state. Again, I want to thank the CDC for the ongoing support. And again, I want to thank the media. They have been a critical partner as we've outlined the preventative measures that folks in the state of Texas need to take place or need to do in order to prevent their families and their loved ones from getting infected. I think I'll stop there, and I'll be open for any questions.
Jennifer, we're ready for the first question and follow-up from the reporter.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Just one moment. And our first question comes from Marin McKenna of Wired Magazine. Your line is open.
Thanks all for doing this. I wondered if either the CDC or the Texas representative could give us a bit more detail about the neuroinvasive cases. Are these mild meningoencephalitides or serious paralytic cases, anything like that?
Yes. Hi, this is Dr. Peterson. The neuroinvasive disease cases are three things. People with meningitis, people with encephalitis, which is an actual infection of the brain itself, or people with acute flaccid paralysis, which is largely due to an infection of the virus of the spinal cord, but other parts of the brain as well. People with meningitis generally are hospitalized, but in the long run do fairly well. People with encephalitis are often left with some kind of neurological deficit over the long run. And about 10% of the people, those people will succumb to the infection. The people with paralysis will, about a third of them will recover nearly completely. A third will be left with some residual weakness, and about a third will have very little recovery from the virus. So the neuroinvasive disease cases in general are severe, and people are often left with long-standing neurological problems.
So following up, can you give us any kind of a breakdown within the neuroinvasive cases, especially in Texas? In other words, how do they conform to those rough categories that you just laid out, or is there any kind of case count for the more severe ones?
I can't speak for Texas, but on the national level, I do not have those data in front of me right now, but we can get those data for you.
And this is David Lakey. That the data that we have is about 95% of these individuals end up being hospitalized. At least 40% have ended up in the intensive care units, and that was in the Dallas area. I think we're a little too early to know the long-term consequences of the outbreak that's taking place right now. But our expectations would be the same as Dr. Peterson has just laid out.
Our next question comes from Richard Knox of National Public Radio. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. What would be the earliest time you would expect to see any impact from the spraying, especially in Dallas County, if it does have the impact you want?
This is Dr. Peterson. I can answer that, and maybe Dr. Lakey can fill in more if necessary. But generally, as Dr. Lakey indicated, that human case reporting is a lagging indicator because it takes time for somebody to get infected, to develop symptoms, then to go to the doctor, and then get diagnosed, and then reported. So even if we stopped West Nile virus transmission tomorrow, you would continue to see many, many cases reported over the coming weeks and even months, possibly. So human cases are lagging indicators, so we will not expect to find to be able to evaluate the effect on human cases for some time. In the short run, what we're looking for is a decrease in mosquito counts after the spraying, and that evaluation is currently being done right now in conjunction with local, state, and a CDC team that's in the Dallas area. And we hope to get some data on that in the upcoming days.
Does Dr. Lakey have anything to say about that?
Hi, this is David Lakey. And I think, again, my comments would be very similar to Dr. Peterson. I think, this is a disease that has an incubation period of 2 to 14 days. And so we anticipate that we'll see more individuals presenting with disease. And then there is the lag between when somebody presents to when they end up in the hospital, or when that data from them ending up in the hospital ends up in the health department. And so that human data, it's going to be, I think, several more weeks before we have that indication. I think on the mosquitoes, though, our folks are looking at that data right now with the CDC team to see if we can have some early indications that the number of mosquitoes has been decreased. I think we'll have that, again, I don't want to jump out, but I think within a week or so, we ought to be able to have some of that mosquito data.
Yeah, this is Dr. Peterson. I would also like to emphasize that there is a reasonably extensive medical literature on the effects of spraying on West Nile virus and related kinds of vector-borne diseases. And what has been noted in fairly well-conducted studies is that after these spray events, when all is said and done, it has shown a marked decrease in human cases compared to areas that have not been sprayed.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Elizabeth Weiss of USA Today. Your line is open.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I had a question about the point that was made earlier looking at the hurricane. You said that there hadn't historically been an uptick in cases after a hurricane. I'm wondering, is that right after? I mean, you'd presume that because there was so much standing water around and perhaps that services that normally might have gone to mosquito abatement were being used elsewhere, that there might be an uptick later. Did you mean never or just not immediately?
What has been observed in the past, and we have a lot of experience with vector-borne diseases and hurricanes and floods over the years, and what has been observed in the past has been that these really do not have a big effect on overall incidence of disease. The reason is because these hurricanes and flood events tend to disrupt the entire ecology of the area and thus interrupt this natural transmission cycle between birds and mosquitoes that the virus normally exists in. And so the end result is that really hurricanes and floods do not have a major impact on arboviral transmission like West Nile virus. But naturally, before the hurricane happened, there were plenty of West Nile virus-infected mosquitoes out there in the environment. And so what was observed in Louisiana after Katrina was that people who were out, maybe their houses were destroyed, they were living out in the elements, there was a lot of workers out there, you know, and homeowners taking care of downed trees and the like, outdoors and exposed to these West Nile virus-infected mosquitoes that were already there. So there, at least in some areas where it was looked at, there was a small transient increase in West Nile virus transmission following Hurricane Katrina. But if you look at the overall picture, the hurricanes really is not expected to have a major impact at all on what is happening across the country.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sherry Jacobson of Dallas Morning News. Your line is open.
Hello. I'm curious on why it's taking so long to figure out the effects on the mosquitoes here in Dallas County, simply because it's been a whole week. It actually has been 2 weeks since the first spraying, and so I'm wondering what exactly you're looking for and why you won't know for another week.
Hi, this is David Lakey. I think we'll have data before the end of the week. They're just doing some complex analysis with the CDC, the state, and locals, making sure we have good sampling in the right areas. There was sampling that took place before the mosquito company sprayed and after. That data looks promising to us, but they're needing to compare that with the overall data throughout that area before a hard statement of the effectiveness that has taken place. I think the initial data that has been reported that they're looking at looks promising. That it looks like there was with those traps from the company, it looks like they were effective, but we want to make sure that we're using that in conjunction with all the other data, again, working with the CDC to make sure we have a good analysis of that data, as complete of analysis as we can. And I think that complete analysis will take a couple more days at least before we have that.
Could I just do a quick follow-up? Are you looking for pregnant mosquitoes who are actually carrying the West Nile virus, or are you just looking for a certain kind of mosquito that is capable of carrying the virus?
They look at several different things. They look at the gravid traps, as you've talked about. They have the CO2 traps that pull in other mosquitoes, and then they have to look to identify to make sure what type of mosquito it is, and is it the vector that you'd expect to carry it. There's some additional tests that are taking place where they send it the mosquito and test pulls by molecular diagnostic tests to see if the virus is in those mosquitoes, and so it's a combination of those tests.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from John Giever of MedPage Today. Sir, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. You've probably been have answered this question before, but what's different this year? Are we having more mosquitoes? Are there changes in the viral genome? Are human social factors different?
That is an excellent question, actually, and one that we're very interested in, clearly. But this has to be put in the perspective of arboviral diseases or mosquito-borne disease outbreaks in general, not only from West Nile, but other kinds of viruses across the world. And it turns out that these outbreaks are very difficult to predict, and they try and figure out what caused them. Because the ecology of these viruses in nature is incredibly complex and is influenced by many, many factors that all interact with each other. So it's really a confluence of environmental factors that are important in determining whether an outbreak will occur. And some of these factors are very difficult to measure. For example, it's one factor that's important is how many birds you have and how many immune birds you have and or how many susceptible birds you have. And that kind of data generally is not available. So there are factors that are important that we just don't have cannot easily measure. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about the heat wave this year and could this have caused or at least partially caused this outbreak? And the answer is yes. The heat wave could have had an important effect on whether this outbreak occurs. We've seen previously that large outbreaks have occurred during heat waves, such as occurred in 2002 and 2003. But there's been other heat waves that have not produced outbreaks, mainly because it's due to a complicated system that's influenced by many factors. So the short answer to your question is we don't know, but the heat wave this year could have been an important contributing factor.
And just a little short follow-up, have you looked at the viral genome, and has there been any evolution over time?
This is an RNA virus, which is a type of virus that is known to mutate all the time. RNA viruses do mutate rather rapidly compared to other kinds of viruses. And we know from looking at the West Nile virus over a number of years in the U.S. that the virus is continuously changing. Now, whether it is changed and has caused some difference causing this year's outbreak is unknown. This is something we're looking at, but it's a complicated process, and you will not get an answer right away, but it is something that we are looking at. We have no evidence right now at this point in time to suggest that this outbreak was caused by a change in the virus itself.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Kathleen Doney of WebMD. Your line is open.
Thank you. Gentlemen, could you speculate on why the number of neuroinvasive cases is now over half, and have you tracked that back through the years? Is the percent of neuroinvasive cases getting higher, and if so, why?
Right. This is. I'm glad you asked this question, and it's a very confusing one, actually. But let me start out with the short answer. And the short answer is neuroinvasive disease cases. Those people almost invariably end out in the hospital and are diagnosed. And so neuroinvasive disease cases are the best measure of what's actually happening with the epidemic, because these cases are reasonably well reported or diagnosed and reported. With the non-neuroinvasive disease cases or West Nile fever, the symptoms can range from no symptoms at all to very mild to actually quite severe and debilitating. And so because of that range of illness, most people actually are not even, they may go to the doctor and the doctor may say, well, you know, I think you've got West Nile fever, there's no treatment, and that person is never tested, or the person may never come to the doctor at all. The symptoms may be mild enough that they'll just stay home. So only about 2 to 3% of people with West Nile fever are actually diagnosed and reported to national surveillance. And another factor is that we don't recommend routine testing for people with suspected West Nile fever since there is no specific treatment. So what the ratio of encephalitis or neuroinvasive disease cases to West Nile fever is an artifact, actually. There are many, many, many cases of West Nile fever that are not reported. So that ratio really doesn't have is not terribly meaningful. Does that answer the question?
Sort of, but just a quick follow-up. So just to focus in on the neuroinvasive, is the likelihood of neuroinvasive disease getting higher through the years?
You mean after somebody gets infected?
Are you more likely, if you're infected in 2012, to get neuroinvasive than in 1999, for instance?
We have no evidence that that's the case. We think that the ratio of neuroinvasive disease cases to infections is a relatively constant number. We have no evidence that that is changing.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Miriam Falco of CNN Medical News Atlanta. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks for taking the questions. One basic question, can you tell me what the age ranges of the deaths, the 66 total deaths, and then also the subsequent pooling of water that can be expected after Isaac is finally done dumping all its water and it's going to be reaching a huge swath of states, could be contributing to more mosquitoes, correct? I mean, I'm just trying to understand why the hurricane doesn't have an effect when standing water is going to be an outcome. Flooding is being expected. So I'm just a little confused about what you were saying earlier on that.
Right. First, to answer your question about the age range of the I believe you asked about the age range of neuroinvasive disease cases.
Well, that and the deaths, the 66 people who have died so far.
Right. If you could contact our press office afterwards, we can get you that data. I just don't have them in front of me right now.
Okay.
And the question about the flooding, the mosquitoes that spread West Nile, which are called Culex mosquitoes, they breed in small nutrient-rich pools of water. So they like small pools of water, like what you might find in a tire or some, you know, water in a tire in somebody's backyard. Now, so what happens is when you get a big rainfall event, many of those small pools of water are simply washed away. So huge floods can certainly eliminate, or heavy rainfall can certainly eliminate breeding sites rather than create them. On the other hand, if the water's been sitting around for a long time and then creates small pools of water as it evaporates, certainly that can promote mosquito breeding sites. And so it's actually a very complicated process, but in the end, what we've observed is we really don't see a huge effect on West Nile virus transmission because some mosquito breeding sites are eliminated and others are created.
Okay, and if I can follow up with Dr. Lakey, just again, and I'm late to this story, so I apologize if I'm being redundant for other reporters. What specifically has been happening in Dallas that is contributing? Has Dallas had more water than usual, or you know, why are so many cases from an environmental perspective in the Dallas area?
I don't think we know yet. I think that there's been several theories. I think Dr. Peterson has laid out some of those that we would agree with related to drought followed by rain in that area. You know, we continue to preach a lot of those messages of making sure you're draining your yards and, you know, the other kind of the four D's that we've all talked about. But, you know, why the outbreak has occurred there in the North Texas area, I don't think we have a full understanding of that yet. Related to your question just a little bit ago about age range, we've had for the neuroinvasive disease, predominantly it's been in the older individuals with rates per 100,000 much higher in the 70 to 79, a rate of 6.3 for those 80 and above of 7.3, but we've had cases in all age range. For 10 to 19-year-olds, we've had an incidence rate of 0.3 per 100,000. For 20 to 29, a 0.6. For 30 to 39-year-old individuals, 1.2. For 40 to 49, an incidence rate of 1.6. And then 50 to 59, of 2.9. And then, I guess, 60 to 69, 3.2. And then the 6.3 and the 7.5 for the older age groups.
Another question. Next question, please.
Next question comes from Robert Lovis of Medscape Medical News. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. What is the status of the developing both a vaccine for West Nile virus and also a treatment for it? I've wondered, since this virus has been it's been here or detected since 99. Why don't we have a vaccine? Why don't we have a treatment? Are there any intrinsic barriers to developing either a treatment or a vaccine? So talk about the status of developing that and whether there's any barrier to developing those two things.
Yeah, let me start. This is Dr. Peterson. Let me start out with the vaccine issue. There are four licensed vaccines for horses. So we know, at least in horses, that we can create an effective vaccine and using a variety of technologies. There has been a few of those vaccines or related vaccines to the horse vaccines that have been conducted in early vaccine clinical trials in phase one and two trials, which have actually been successful. The problem has been with instituting a phase three vaccine is that we're dealing with a low incidence disease most years of cases that are widely dispersed and often, and so the thought of trying to produce a phase three clinical trial to show efficacy is fairly daunting. In addition to the fact that we can't totally predict what's going to happen with West Nile virus incidence in upcoming years, and so there's a tremendous market risk as well to a vaccine manufacturer. And so for those reasons, there's been no vaccine that's been taken to a phase three clinical trial. Now, as far as the treatment goes, there's two issues. One issue is there, even with related diseases like Japanese encephalitis, which have a much higher incidence in endemic areas, there has been no treatment that's been shown to be effective in randomized clinical trials. So West Nile virus is not Japanese encephalitis, but the bottom line is it's difficult to make a drug that you can prove that's going to be efficacious for this kind of a virus. The second problem is that a number of clinical trials have been started, randomized clinical trials, but none of them has been able to be taken to completion because of low patient enrollment. And that for the same reasons that you have problems with doing clinical or trials with vaccines, you have the same problems with trying to prove a drug is effective, and that this is a low incidence disease, that cases are widely dispersed, and so you end up having to enroll hundreds of hospitals trying to get enough cases. And some years are low incidence years, and some years are high incidence years. And so it turns out that trying to get enough patients into a randomized clinical trial is difficult, and because you can't predict where the disease is going to occur. In addition, West Nile is largely a rural and suburban disease, and where patients show up or present to hospitals are not the ones traditionally that do clinical trials. And so there's a number of logistic problems that have made clinical trials for treatment very, very difficult in practice.
Well, I have one follow-up question. Can you just maybe expand on why it's hard to make a drug that can prove to be effective for this kind of virus? You compared it to this infection to Japanese encephalitis. What can you explain that a little more amplification?
Well, part of the problem is that by the time patients present, and the ones you're concerned about are people with neuroinvasive disease. And so by the time somebody's come in with neuroinvasive disease, the virus has already invaded their central nervous system. And that makes it very difficult, both from a drug delivery standpoint, because it's got to be able to enter the central nervous system in high concentrations, or at least in sufficient concentrations to take care of the infection. Plus, some neurological damage has already probably been done since the virus has already invaded the central nervous system. So, and we know that these infections progress rather rapidly in most people. And so the combination of that in practice has made it very difficult to try and find an efficacious drug. Plus, as you know, there aren't a lot of drugs in our pharmaceutical armamentarium that are antivirals. There's a lot more antibacterials than there are antivirals.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from David Nogueras of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. Here in Oregon, we had our first two human cases of West Nile virus confirmed yesterday. I wonder, from the perspective of the public here that's following the news, following the work of reporters that might be on this call, and they see all the activity in Texas, I wonder if they might be less likely to go out and buy bug spray than, say, somebody in Dallas. What should a member of the public in some of these states like ours that have relatively few cases, what should they conclude about their risk of contracting West Nile and getting sick from it?
Okay. Well, I think the one thing to remember is that the virus is endemic at this point throughout almost the entire United States. You know, certain areas like maybe high in the Rocky Mountains may not have it, but most of the United States, the virus is endemic and it circulates every year. It's just a matter of how much. And so what we've observed is a very high rate of transmission in certain states this year, less transmission in other states, but it doesn't mean that there's no risk in other areas. There is a risk almost everywhere in the U.S. We're certainly in areas where they have had outbreaks or are having high numbers of cases, we're certainly emphasizing that people follow the recommended precautions. In other areas, the risk may be lower, but it's still not zero. And West Nile virus isn't the only mosquito-borne virus out there as well. So I think it's prudent to follow the precautions no matter where you are.
No follow-up for me. Thank you.
Another question? Follow-up?
Our next question comes from Maggie Fox of NBC News. Your line is now open.
Hi. I just wanted to ask that everybody get all the numbers, please. Can we all have the numbers on the age ranges and the numbers of ages impacted? And Dr. Lakey, you threw out some really interesting numbers there. And if we could get those somewhere, maybe they're on your website, which is really good, by the way, that would help. taking it down shorthand is a bit difficult.
I understand that, and my public information officer will have that data, and we'll make sure that's available to folks.
That's great. Thank you. I didn't have any further questions.
Okay, we'll be taking our last question now.
And our last question comes from Lindsay Connect of KERA News. Your line is now open. Ms. Connect?
If we have anyone else in queue?
We do. Don Finley of San Antonio Express News.
Thank you.
We've been hearing about transplant patients maybe at higher risk of developing neuroinvasive disease. I was wondering if other immune-compromised groups, cancer patients, diabetics, might be at similar risk, or is there something unique about transplants?
The answer to your question is that there's a variety of conditions that have been shown to be at increased risk for West Nile. People with kidney disease, for example, people with cancer or other immunocompromising conditions certainly have been shown to be at increased risk. It's oftentimes hard to define exactly the degree of risk because there's different strata within the broad category of immunocompromised, but certainly kidney disease was actually one of the things we discovered was a risk factor. Cancer is another risk factor. People who have had transplants are another risk factor, as you point out, because they are taking immunosuppressives. People who may take immunosuppressives for other reasons, such as rheumatoid arthritis or some other conditions, may also be at increased risk.
Thank you.
Well, we'd like to thank everyone for their participation today. We will have an audio file as well as a transcript available after we have closed this telebriefing today. If you have questions for the media that you'd like to direct to CDC, from the media for CDC, you can call our office, which is the CDC News Media Branch at 404-639-3286, 404-639-3286. If you have questions that are specific for Texas or Dr. Lakey, you can reach out to Kerry Williams, who is his press officer or press director, at 512-776-7119. That is 512-776-7119. Again, thank you for your participation today.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.